There was a sickening crunch behind me as Sparky had first his arms crushed, then his skull. BT wrapped an arm around my side and hefted me up into his arms. I'm not sure if I should be ashamed to admit this, but I felt sort of like the damsel in distress being saved by the dashing hero as he swept me up. That ended quick enough when he threw me over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes. If the world ever got its head screwed back on, I was so going to make an action figure of him. There I was, waterlogged and broken, draped over his shoulder like an unneeded coat on a warm night, while with the other arm he is firing a machine gun. I mean, that shit is just iconic, right? He tossed me into the bed of the pickup truck before hopping in himself. Two slaps on the truck top and we were thrown into reverse, and with a screech of tires, I was whisked away into the night. Wasn't a few seconds later I passed out from exhaustion. Chapter 6. Mike Journal Entry 6. I awoke with a start. I was under 5 blankets. At first it was comforting, and then I realized I was baking hot and started throwing covers off me. "Hold on, man," BT said, shielding his eyes. "You don't have anything on under there." I wisely threw only 4 of the blankets off and was left with a light one that made it much more comfortable. We were in a small house, and I was on a couch, settled fairly close to a roaring fire. "What's going on?" I repositioned myself so I was sitting up. "Here, eat this, and I'll give you an update. Pork belly," he said, as he handed it over. "Not ham, right?" I asked, looking at the meat. "You turn down food right now," he asked. "If I'd found you in the same situation and you were laying here just barely holding on, and I handed you a plate with your mac and cheese mixed in with your meatloaf, would you eat it?" "Of course I wouldn't. Now you're just talking crazy. Who the hell mixes up foods that have no right to be mixed together? We're not animals." "That's how I feel about ham." "It's not ham, man. You want me to tell you what's going on, or you want to talk about pork products?" The pork belly was a little on the salty side, but still delicious. I tore into that thing. I nodded at him to go on. All the social graces of a turkey vulture. I stopped eating. The fuck does that even mean? They'll vomit on their food to keep others from eating it. "Really, man? You're comparing me to that?" He shrugged. "Just tell me what's going on and I won't talk about dipping my bacon in maple syrup." It was funny to watch the big man gag. "Or pour milk over my collard greens." "Huh. Sugar-frosted collard green cereal." "When are you not a dick? Since that is a rhetorical question, I'll just keep talking while you think on it. Tracy, Justin, and the rest are fine. Tommy and Travis are keeping surveillance. Don't worry, it is from a safe distance. They're using lasers and Morse code to talk." "Not too surprised Tommy would know Morse, but Justin? Freeze off a few brain cells. Winters is with them." "Right, sorry. Wait, where'd they get lasers?" "Dude, they just fucking have them. Are you gonna hit me up with the finer points throughout this whole thing? They all have their bootlaces tied, their rifles are locked and loaded, everyone has had a bathroom break." "Who's being the dick now?" I asked. "Sorry, man. I'm so worried about your sister." He looked straight at me, as if daring me to say something inflammatory. "I already consider you a brother. Nothing would make me feel better than to say you are actually family." "Still a dick by not being a dick. How do you do it? How do you make me feel like shit for yelling at you, even when you deserve it?" "It's a tactic I developed with my mother. I could infuriate and confuse her all at the same time. Kept her off balance." "You pull that shit with Tracy?" "Oh, hell no. She wouldn't put up with it." "What makes you think I will?" he asked. I could only smile. "We're in a world of shit," I told BT. "Knox has the satellite system." "I was going to wait until maybe you felt a little better, but Sanders believes he knows where Dano is." I knew what was going to happen if I sat up too fast. Did it anyway. Very nearly swooned. "Why aren't we on our way?" "Well, the only reason Sanders knows where they are is because he's stumbled into a pretty secure stronghold of Knox's." "I hate that woman, and I would risk just about everything to get rid of her. He says he's not sure if Dano is being held or is there of her own volition." Fuck. Maybe we let her stay there, and then she'll be Knox's problem, and eventually she'll do the same to him as she's done to a good, long line of people. Maybe she's our infectious plant. Take them down from the inside. What about the rest of the people that were with her? It hurt to ask this question. My sister, nephew, brother, daughter, and grandson had been among the people in that car. Already knew the fate of Mad Jack. It was not a stretch at all to believe that had, or would, happen to every one of them. We are going to get everyone back, Mike. We'll take care of Knox, and we'll do what we set out to do. Any news on Trip? Nothing. But we're talking about Trip. Good chance they're holed up in a snack cake factory. I smiled at that. When are we going to get Tracy? As soon as you are able to move. Another thing, though, Mike. Kylie is a nurse. She looked at your ankle. She knew it was broken. And she knew it was healing at an incredible pace. She's suspicious. I don't have time to worry about that. Any chance you have enough time to worry about getting dressed? He said. I grabbed a blanket quickly as Kylie spoke from the other room. Your clothes are almost dry. You may want to put them on, she said. Are they clean? I asked BT. This looked like a laundromat? I mean, sure, we wiped off some of the bigger globs, but you still smell like low tide in New Jersey. Like dead fish and washed-up gangsters, is that what you're implying? Along those lines. I'm going to get out of here while you put some clothes on. I've seen enough pasty Talbot ass for a good long while. Have you? Have you seen enough Talbot ass? BT turned. He did not look like a happy camper. A big, meaty finger came up. That's your sister you're talking about. She'd laugh if she were here. That's the problem, though, isn't it? BT let his head dip as he walked out. How are you doing? Kylie had waited a minute while I got my clothes on. I wasn't in the mood for answering questions, but at least it distracted me from the disgusting feel of my slightly damp and definitely moldy clothes. I looked up from the magazine I was loading. Great! I plastered on as fake a smile as I could. What are you? She asked. Without any type of warning, she was going to dive right into the deeper end of the pool. A husband, father, brother, and Marine that very desperately wants to get his family back together. Near as I can tell, you had a bimalleolar ankle fracture less than 12 hours ago. With a proper set, splinting, good diet, and positive outlook, it would take a minimum of 6 weeks to heal. Yet you seem nearly whole. Must be wrong about your diagnosis. I mean, how would I be able to step down on it? Which I did, with maybe a bit too much vigor. Might have been able to throw a little more shade on her inquisition if I hadn't winced as I did so. Hold your leg up and rotate your ankle. I hurt it, okay? There's no doubt about that. Right now, I'm not going to do anything further to aggravate it, not when I still have so much to do. What would I see if I took a sample of your blood? Red, I would imagine, I told her. Marines are tough, Talbot, I get that, but they don't shrug off broken ankles, she said, as I squeezed past her at the door, making sure she got a good old whiff of the essence I was cloaked in. Sanders and Biddeford were out in the garage going over a fairly decent mock-up of the house Tracy was in. You're up, Sanders asked. Yeah, ready to go, I told him. My wife said you have a broken ankle. Must be wrong. He looked at me. Good enough. We can always use the help, although I'm not going to be the one that tells her she was wrong. Good news is most of the zombies left with the pool maneuver. He pointed to a smashed-up water bottle. While you were sleeping, Biddeford and myself mounted some reinforced plywood walls on the truck bed. Now we just have to get the truck into position, extend the 24-foot ladder, and get everyone out. Wouldn't a bucket truck or a fire truck be better? I asked. The bucket truck is slow. Remember how long it took just to get them into the attic? Getting them into a cherry picker would take an inordinate amount of time, and we just don't have it. The fire truck is unwieldy. If we found ourselves in a chase, it would be highly unlikely we would be able to shake our pursuers. Besides, there's not much room for passengers in either vehicle. Pickup truck it is, I said. We took a stealthy approach to where they had left the truck, and in 10 minutes we had arrived. Biddeford spun the wheel and was going in reverse nearly as fast as he had been going forward. He did his best to avoid the zombies, although he still hit two. A decent spray of misted viscera came up and over our impromptu wall and splashed across my chest. "For once, I'm glad I'm not clean," I said, as I plucked something that looked a lot like an optic nerve from my pants. There weren't many zombies around, but let's be honest, one is too many. We were dealing with 20 times that number. Sanders was adamant that we were not to use firearms, as Knox's patrols were running all through the city, and our earlier shots had drawn them closer. The truck was taking some dings as zombies were running into it. Biddeford was working on the ladder. I was trying to slam zombie heads with my buttstock, but I didn't have the heft or the angle to do it well. And let's be real, it wasn't like I was swinging an M1 Garand around. The wood on that thing was designed to become a headbanger when ammo became an issue. But the lighter 5.56s had composite stocks designed to be lightweight. It was more likely I'd break the stock than a zombie's head. BT reached down into the truck bed and picked up an aluminum bat. He stood tall, rolled his shoulders and his head a couple of times, took a breath, admired the bat before turning to absolutely destroy the zombie I could barely shoo away. The classics, am I right? He brought the weapon over his head again, moved slightly to the side, and caved in a zombie's skull so deeply the rest of the head appeared to fall into its neck. I did what was prudent and just stepped back and into a squat as he swung another 10 times. Each time a kill was visually confirmed. He was up there, vying for a spot on the Most Disgusting Things I'd Witnessed award, not to mention Hall of Fame RBI stats. By the time he was done, he was breathing heavy. The bat had some serious dents in it, and he'd spilled enough brain matter he could have painted an elephant with it. "You look like you enjoyed that," I said to him, breaking through the haunted look he was wearing. "You all right, BT?" I asked when he didn't respond. "I will be," he said, looking for something else to annihilate. I turned my attention to where I could help. Biddeford had the ladder against the roof, and the evacuation was happening. Justin had brought Avalyn down and went back up to grab Angel from Tracy. Once he was down with her, I had to go up and get Henry, first because he was a big dog and unwieldy, and if anyone was going to take a tumble saving him, it would be me. And secondly, he wouldn't budge for anyone else. He was having none of that ladder. I had to promise him a box full of cookies, even though I could not deliver on that just yet. The look I got from him when I put him down on the truck bed and didn't give the four-legged stomach anything to eat was priceless. Then I remembered that bulldogs had perhaps one of the strongest bites in the dog world and thought better of my smile. I scowled and solemnly promised he would get the first goodie I found. Justin was coming down again with the other dogs when I saw Carol got a bit of vertigo. It was touch and go there for a few seconds as Tracy did her best to keep her mother on the roof. I moved Justin out of the way. If there had been a ladder racing event, I'm pretty sure I would have taken home a medal as I went up to make sure she was staying put, along with my wife. The zombies that were still in the house, once they realized that their guests were leaving, were coming outside to see them off. "I can't go down that," Carol said, as she tried to squeeze my hand off. "Not much of a choice," I told her. "The zombies are gone now. I'll just go down the stairs." This was my mother-in-law, and I loved her. But I was starting to see why some married couples moved away from their families. "We don't have time, Carol. We could be spotted at any moment, and we'd still have to get you out of the attic. You're forgetting how difficult it was to get you up there?" "I understand, Alan, I do. But I left the oven on." Tracy looked at me. Stress sometimes forces the issue. Alzheimer's or dementia, or maybe a little bit of both, was rearing its oh-so-ugly fucking head. None of us were taught to deal with this in a battlefield scenario. Someone said something crazy, you just shoved them on forward. I rubbed my head before I spoke. "We'll go down this ladder and shut the oven off," I told her. "You always were a sweet talker, Alan." Carol's hand lingered on my face. "I think it's times like this you want to start creating new words, because uncomfortable didn't even scratch the surface. I felt more like Zardreth, as prickly off the tongue as my insides were feeling. "Yeah, Alan, come on. Help her get to the oven. My wife wasn't playing with me. She was playing along with her mom to get them the hell off the roof. We should pick a better hotel, Alan. The staff here is very rude, she said, just loud enough to me so Tracy would know she was talking about her. Biddy, get them the fuck down. I'm hearing engines. Sanders was leaning out the driver's side window. You heard that, right? Biddeford called up. Carol?
Yes, dear, she asked, with eyes that were reserved for lovers only.
Zardreth. Tracy, come on, help me, we have to move. Unhand me, she said to Tracy. This is assault, and I will not stand for it. BT had finished his killing spree and handed the bat off to Justin as he came up to help. He didn't even fuck around. He pushed past me, grabbed Carol, and draped her over his shoulder like he had me, maybe a little more gently. She was ineffectually beating against his back. Tracy went next, and I was last. We'd no sooner pulled the ladder down when headlights swept onto the street. Sanders shut the engine down. The zombies were grumbling and groaning, making a fair amount of noise as they slapped and slammed up against the truck. A spotlight shined on the roof of the house. From their angle on the street, they would not have been able to see the impromptu exit. The light was tracking down, but was blocked by the fence before it could see us. They're looking for us. Why aren't they using the satellite? BT asked. Might be a blackout time, I told him. I hate to know, he said.
Yeah, we all feel the same way, Tracy replied.
The truck was slowly retreating down the roadway, now gathering its own zombie following. I was letting out a sigh of relief when Carol began to scream. I looked around wildly for the zombie that had to have been eating her before she clarified,
"My brooch! Who stole my brooch?"
This followed by a mournful wailing. I didn't know what to do. My first inclination was to wrap my hand around her mouth, but it was my mother-in-law. Biddeford had no such reservations as he dragged her down. Lucky thing he had gloves on, because she was gnawing on his palm. Of course, the truck stopped, idled for a moment, then began backing up. This was when the screechers made their debut. A blessing and a curse. My guess was they had been called up from the bullpen when they were informed that a clutch of humans had been corralled, and they were coming to force them out. Even through the brain-splitting sound the screechers made, it was easy enough to figure out that the bulkers would be next. What the screechers tried for in subtlety, the bulkers would make up for in gentle passivity. Sanders started the truck back up. Either Knox's men didn't feel we were worth battling a horde to get to, or thought we were already about to become chow. In any case, they took off. We pulled out of the lawn, threw a few zombies, and into the night. I looked up, knowing that at some point we were going to be on camera. We needed that device, otherwise they could follow us to the ends of the earth. Maybe Etna Station could help, but maybe they wouldn't want to. Who the fuck were we to them? Entirely too much trouble, that too. I could not justify bringing destruction to another base. I realized there was no way I could have known Eliza would do what she'd done, but Knox was fucking nuts and pain was still out there, and this fuckfest was on me. These things needed to be dealt with before we asked for sanctuary. When you think zombie apocalypse, this running from human madmen is not what immediately springs to mind. I went back to that perfect post-apocalyptic world. You were holed up in a well-stocked Sam's Club that has been made into an impregnable fortress. You have enough guns, ammo, and video games to make North Korea salivate. All of your friends and family are with you. It's like a big fucking party. You go up onto the roof in the morning, play some betting games to see who can thin the zombie horde out the most. You drink some beer and eat some beef jerky before wrapping up your day by going downstairs to have some roast chicken and potatoes, kept nice by solar-powered generators. You revel in the fact that April 14th just passed and you don't have any taxes to pay or a boss to give you shit. No commute to stoke your ire. No rude fuck at the movie theater talking or texting during the movie. None of it. It's like a fantasy world. All the shit of society vanishes, and you're there, alive and safe, on your own little island. But in reality, you're always covered in muck and slime and loss,
Everything else is just a fantasy, and the joke's on us. The Z-Pak, in a couple of words, sucked balls. I'd watched as friends and family died all around me, unable to save them. We were always on high alert, always under threat, and seemingly always running. There was no such thing as safe. I figured there would be desperate people looking to take what was ours, but I guess I imagined just bringing them into the fold. Never in my wildest dreams did I consider that every evil, low-life, crazy motherfucker would band together and become an army of asshats. The meek couldn't inherit the earth because the jerks kept trying to take it from them. We met Tommy and Travis at a safe house. I did my best to not cry from joy, as most of my family members were reunited, and from worry, as some were still in danger. Sanders had Biddeford and Winters guarding different sides of the house as he continually paced around. "I'm sorry about this, and thankful," I told him. "I didn't mean to bring this kind of shitstorm into your life." "You're a Marine, right?" he asked. "I am." "Marines never leave one of their own behind," he repeated. I knew that, but I guess I kept thinking, as circumstances got worse, they would eventually run out on us. "What if you find out Knox was in?" I asked. "Oh, not that shitbird. No way was he in my beloved corps. I would have made personally sure he washed out. Plus, he's too stupid to have been a Marine." "Don't think I've heard that one before," I told him. "Yeah, anyone that crosses me is too stupid." I gave him a much-needed laugh, on my part anyway. He was deadly serious about it. "What now?" I asked. "We need to get that sat-track device back. We can't scratch our ass without them knowing it. And you seem like a decent guy, Talbot, but I'd rather spend my nights with my wife, and I can't do that if they know where we're going. And don't apologize. I take this as a personal challenge." We needed this exercise. I think we were getting a little lackadaisical. I could see Winters out of the corner of my eye, shaking his head. I would have laughed again, but it might have got the sergeant in trouble. Sanders was thinking. "It stands to reason they will attack this house. They will know we're here. The question is, how can we set something up to where we surprise them? Going to need to snatch one so we can find out where Knox is. The device only has 15 minutes every hour. We have a 75% chance of moving without them seeing us," I said. "You're okay with those odds?" he asked. "Shit, sir, those are the best odds I've been afforded in a good long time. And we could increase that by sending out teams at 15-minute intervals. One will be seen, the rest won't." "You weren't an officer." Now it was BT's turn to laugh. "Of latrine duty, maybe," he said. "I finally come up with a plan, and you're going to give me shit about it?" BT merely shrugged. It was a decent plan, and it wasn't. If Knox and his men saw me moving and came for us, that was great. If it was Tommy and Travis they spotted, that was bad. It would depend on what kind of response they sent and how fast the rest of us could make it there to close the loop of the trap off. And to make it more difficult, we had to have a plan of attack for four locations. Logistically, it was a nightmare. Luckily, Knox was playing it much more cautiously since we'd been bleeding him continuously. We settled on a cul-de-sac that had been reserved for doctors and lawyers. Each and every house was a McMansion, close to 5,000 square feet, and I'm sure had price tags over $1 million each. I couldn't even begin to comprehend what the nut on that was each month. The basis was my idea. Sure, Sanders cleaned up the rough edges, but this one was my responsibility. So BT and I were the first out. We headed out on foot as fast as we could, knowing that if the timing was fucked up, it could potentially give Knox enough time to watch where we went and then see another team leaving our headquarters. We just had to hope that luck was more on our side than his, considering I was using my family as bait. Yeah, that was sitting wonderfully in my gut, wriggling around like a fat, wet mass of live maggots. Once all the fire teams got into position, it was Tracy's job to pretend to take her sweet-ass time loading up the animals, the kids, and Carol, and bring them to the central house. A nice, easy trail of breadcrumbs. It was an hour and a half later when we were all in position, and still nothing happened. "He's not biting," I said to BT as I looked out the window. He will. He can't not do it. How are you so sure? I turned to look at him. He's insane. He can't not do it. Have a lot of experience with insanity, do you? I asked. He just kept looking at me. Oh, by now you could say I was an expert. Fuck you. I turned back to the window when I heard the high whine of props. Drone. Like I was saying. I gave him the finger off to the side, not taking my gaze from the window, as I tried to find the small flying machine. That's helpful, I said as I moved back. What's going on? BT didn't want to come over and potentially get caught looking. It's literally in the middle of the road, doing a slow spin, surveying the area. So they know we're here. We know they know we're here. But they're not really telling us which house they suspect we're in. Do you think they got our little ploy figured out? He asked. Sanders must have been thinking the same thing because a single shot was fired from his location. The drone spun wildly as one of the props was sheared off. I'd like to say it crashed hard and there was a concussive fireball, but it more or less came down gently. Whoever was at the controls wasn't quite ready to let their toy go as they tried to make it rise with three props. It struggled to lift, but did not have the proper thrust. Finally, it stopped. Either the battery gave out or the operator realized the futility. After 10 minutes of no trucks driving up with dozens of men spilling out, I was feeling worse for it. I know, strange reaction. Who actually wants to get into a firefight? But that was what we'd been planning for. When the enemy does something different, that's when you have to start watching your ass. The unexpected is always a bitch because, by definition, you're not ready for it. We'd come to the decision to pick these particular houses for a variety of reasons. Proximity to where we'd been and how close to each other were the most obvious. Also, that the approach from behind was impractical. However, it wasn't impassable. Let's face it, the super rich don't really like rubbing elbows with the masses. Maybe they're afraid they'll catch middle class syndrome or a poor people virus. So these houses had a small patch of woods behind them with a thick ribbon of swampy wetlands, a kind of moat, you might say. Not much more than a shallow bog, but it would keep most casual walkers or hikers, their dogs, and maybe even thieves from coming that way. I mean, not even us poor folk want to walk around in wet shoes. Sure, the mosquitoes must be brutal during the summer, but it's better than dealing with those people. They're coming from the back, I said, heading for the door that led out to the yard. I knew it without having one shred of factual intel. Mike, you of all people should know we can't leave our post. I stopped for a handful of heartbeats. I'm thinking you've been around Sanders for a little too long, buddy. I was in the Marines and then I left because I have a serious hang-up regarding authority, and that's our family in that house across the street. What if I'm right and we're waiting here manning our post? But Mike, you never see the other side of the coin. What if you're wrong? There's another side? I was already halfway through the door. As I was running, I glanced at the house on our left. Winters was at the window. He was pointing vigorously and must have been asking Sanders what the fuck I was doing. I pointed to the back. He was trying to figure out what I was looking at, but I couldn't see anything wrong, so it was safe to say he couldn't either. The yard was decent-sized, but not Texas ranch-sized. There was only about an acre of overgrown lawn before we crossed into a small patch of woods. According to Sanders, it was another 100 yards to the protected wetlands. I got us in deep enough we were covered from the rear by some trees before I stopped and sought total cover. Mike, what the fuck are we doing out here? If you had to take a piss, you should have just used the toilet, BT said. You fucking nuts? How long you think it's been since that thing was cleaned? I'm not lifting that lid to see an 8-month-old turd growing all sorts of fungal spores. Fungal spores. Nature Channel, watch it sometime. It's a little more informative than Australian rules football. Don't go there, man. I placed my finger near my mouth, then pointed. 3 heavily armed and camouflaged men were off to our side, cautiously approaching. Fuck, I hate it when you're right. Makes you damn near insufferable, he'd said so close to my ear I thought he might just come in all the way and blow me a kiss. I mean, what was I going to be able to do to stop him? Instead, he low-crawled to a tree next to mine. But we're talking BT, so it was almost like he was standing upright, like us normal-sized humans. "Want a strobe light?" I asked caustically, meaning he'd have a harder time being less inconspicuous. We each had suppressors on our weapons, thanks to Sanders, but a shot would still sound like two pieces of wood slapping together. Might not be heard from too far out, thanks to all the brush where we were, but these three guys would most definitely hear it. That wasn't a huge problem, because two of them would either be incapacitated or dead. Disarming the third and hoping there weren't more behind him was the problem. We would be forced to fire as soon as they were abreast of us, and unless they were wearing blinders, we'd be seen. I had a chest shot all lined up, had a few pounds of pressure on the trigger when BT quietly said, "Mike." I knew what that meant. We had company. "How many?" I said, not taking my sights off my target, though I had eased up on the trigger. 4, was his reply. It was 7-on-2, and we could make it 5-on-2 soon enough, but then our element of surprise was shot, so to speak, and they had bigger, faster weapons. "Pick a target," I told him. "We're going for this." He wasn't a fan. No choice now. Probably liked that answer less, though he said nothing. What was happening was right in front of us. Couldn't ignore it, couldn't pay it no attention and hope it would go away. We were deep in it now. "Concentrate on the right." My reasoning here was that if we took those three out, we'd have an avenue to run if we needed to. "I have the one farthest away," I told him. It wasn't more than 25 yards. At this point, could have thrown a rock and hit them. BT's rifle cracked a fraction of a second before mine. It was so nearly simultaneous that my victim hadn't even had a chance to react to seeing the man he was with go down. The third one was winged by one of us. He went down fast, but not because of a fatal shot. That was something he was trying to avoid. It was only another moment before BT and I were hugging the ground. The trees around us were catching hellacious and sustained machine gun fire. Even if we weren't directly hit, we would soon be in danger of the falling trees. Ever watch the movie Predator with Arnold? There's a scene in the beginning when they know they're being hunted, and all of these mercenaries line up with this incredible weaponry, and they're just blasting the living shit out of all the fauna. Trees are exploding, branches are falling, leaves are disintegrating. As a guy, it is a truly monumental movie scene to watch. When you're living it on the receiving end, well, it sucks. And it sucks big time. "Brilliant fucking idea, Talbot," BT shouted. I could barely hear him over the expulsion of so many high-speed projectiles. The lone man on our right wasn't firing, and he wasn't moving. There was no way yet to know if he was out of the fight. Could be just lying low until we walked into his sight of fire. Not like we could get there anyway. The four on the other side were keeping us pinned with superior firepower, and not only that, they were tactically leapfrogging closer to us, and there wasn't a fucking thing we could do about it for fear of having our heads riddled with bullets. I had to think at some point they would run low on ammo, but this was not something we could count on. They'd be on us in a minute or two at best. "I'm sorry," I told BT. "Not yet, man, not yet." He pointed behind us and to the left. The Marines were coming. Well, one Marine anyway. Winters must have followed us. He was low crawling into position, making sure that every shot he fired counted. I'll take one Marine over 4 Mercs any day. Even through the blistering sounds of the heavy 7.62 rounds obliterating everything in their path, we heard Winters, who had a Barrett M99 50 caliber. I'd never shot one, personally. Seemed too much like overkill. Yeah, that was until I felt, not just heard, the percussion as he sent that monster bullet downrange. His target didn't just fall down. It was lifted and blown backward. If it hadn't been for a tree behind him, he may still have been going, like a leaf taken hold by a gale. I could have driven my fist straight through that unfortunate bastard and not touched any human material. That was not a bullet designed for mere flesh to catch. Winters got another round off before the two remaining started spreading their suppressive fire around. The second man that Winters hit had been in the midst of diving for cover, and in a series of disastrous circumstances, ducked right into the path of the oncoming projectile. The devastation was immediate and profound. Let me see if I can paint the scene right. So you take some random bad guy's head, you neatly remove it from his body, you puree the thing in an industrial food processor, when it is nothing more than a heavy concentration of reddish-gray pulp, you pour the contents into a large spray bottle. When you're ready, pull the pump repeatedly and watch as the contents mist all over everything you were pointing it at, almost like an anti-Windex. That's what I saw when the bullet pulverized that man. My guess was his soul was still wandering around, trying to figure out why he couldn't fire a gun anymore, and why no one was paying him any attention, because there was no way he knew he was dead. The transition had been too sudden and traumatic. Two to our left, one to our right. Winters had caught the group unawares, but now that they knew where he was actually in a pretty bad spot, mostly wide open. I didn't think the hydrangea bush he was behind was going to stop much. Only one man was firing at him. I'm thinking the other guys had seen what a 50 cal could do and were having none of it. The one still in the battle was lining up on Winters, more or less forgetting about BT and myself. I stood up to get a better shot. Nearly cost me my life as he turned and sprayed a half dozen rounds my way. Want to know what saved me? The size of his magazine. He ran out of rounds an inch or two from riddling me. I took that as a personal affront and put four or five rounds into him. He stutter-stepped backwards. His rifle fell from his hands a moment before he himself toppled over. "I surrender! I surrender!" the fourth man said. That was all great and fine, but we still had at least one off to our right. "Stand up," I shouted, "and if I see a gun, I will kill you." He did as I said, hands high up in the air. BT stood as well. "Interlock your fingers and place them over your head," he shouted. I had turned to make sure we weren't blindsided by the other guy. Winters was now up and had the Barrett pointed at our prisoner. Looked somewhat like he had a howitzer. Could have driven a fucking VW down that barrel. "I've got zip ties," Winters said. "You cover him. I'll get him handcuffed." "I've got you," BT responded. "Be right back," I told BT. "Just wait a minute," BT looked over his shoulder. I saw movement. "Even more of a reason," he replied, although I was already moving away. I took note of the two men that would be lying right where they were until they became one with the earth again, but it was the blood of the one missing that had me transfixed. The part of me I did my best to ignore was completely enraptured with the fluid that was pouring from the wounded man. There was enough of it that I wondered how he had even managed to move. He was leaving a thick trail of blood globs, and I was following it like a fat kid might a luring root of gummy bears. The man was no more than 50 feet ahead of me. He was hunched over, one hand on a tree for support, and the other, I would imagine, was attempting to stem the tide that had sprung forth from him. He was half-turned when he heard me approach. "Please," he groaned. He didn't have the strength to beg for his life or for me to finish him. I came up warily as he slumped to the ground. His eyes were locked on mine. I alternated between his gaze and the blood that issued from his splayed hand. I should have shot him and been done with it. I couldn't. Ripping into his neck and feeding the monster inside of me was fast approaching to the fore. If not for BT trampling through the woods to make sure I was all right, I think I would have succumbed right there and then. The man's eyes were glazed over, and he was reflexively gasping for air as his body had not quite caught on that his mind had given it up. "Mike," BT said as he approached cautiously. I had not moved, almost didn't hear his words. He shook my shoulder gently. He never said anything, but he knew I'd been having an internal struggle. "We've got a prisoner. Come on, let's go." I turned to look at him, and he stepped back. Your teeth, man. Your eyes. Get your shit together." I had to shake my head several times before I was able to shake the demons away. I'm good." But I didn't feel good. Like a man lost in the desert, I'd been shown a jug of water only to have it removed before I could bring the life-giving fluid to my lips. I was thirsty. Oh, so fucking thirsty. I would regretfully come back to that moment for a few days before I was able to submerge it down with the other vile things that sometimes pass across my thoughts. Those things that, by my will, thankfully, never see the light of day. Chapter 7. Mike, Journal Entry 7. If Knox was planning something else for us, it was in the long game. We got our prisoner, a one Barry Smintner. Sounded like someone that should be playing tennis at the country club with Mimsy, but he was as far from money as a monkey is from driving a car. Let me take that back. With enough training and under the right circumstances, I'm pretty sure a monkey could drive a car.
"You killed me, friends," he glowered in the small room.
We'd left the cul-de-sac and went a street over. Odds were that the 5 minutes we'd been exposed were not on Knox's screen.
"Me friends," BT asked me.
We were off to the side. "You think he might be slow?"
"Knox is going to come here and kill you all."
There was a sinister sneer on his face. "Slow or not, he's a piece of shit," I said, wanting to beat that upward-tilting lip right off his face. "You ready?" Sanders asked Biddeford. The other man nodded.
"Hey, what are you doing? I'm part of the Knox army. You can't do anything to me. I'm untouchable."
Biddeford punched the man hard enough it hurt me. "You tell us what we want to know and we won't do anything to you."
"Much." "How's that?" Sanders asked. "I ain't telling you shit."
There was still a sneer, but it had dropped a little of its pop. As part of my officer's training, Sanders enlightened our prisoner, I was part of an exercise called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, and that is including active hot zones. That being said, when we were captured, which was inevitable, by the way, part of the process was being waterboarded. Sanders continued in an almost fatherly way, certainly as a good teacher might. In my head, I was thinking, how bad can it be? Sure, I was captured, but we were still all on the same team, right? They weren't going to seriously injure or maim me. So you're lying down and restrained. An old shirt is stretched tight over your face and head so you can't move. And then water is poured over your head. Sounds fairly pedestrian, really. But Barry, I'm going to tell you something. When that water starts splashing up your nose and into your mouth, some primitive instinct kicks in. Between the darkness and the drowning, well, I don't know if I've been more scared in my life. And it wasn't a rational fear, not something I could control. I knew where I was and who I was with, but the sheer panic in my body and brain completely took over.
"You can't do that shit. There's some sort of rules of engorgement," he shouted.
"Listen, I realize I have the mentality of a 5-year-old, but if this hadn't been such a serious scene, I would have busted out laughing." I turned my head and coughed. Sanders nodded to Biddeford as he and Winters pulled the zip-tied man down to his knees.
"I'd rather not do this."
"You ready to do a little talking?" Sanders asked. They picked the man up and placed him on a table.
"How about now?"
"How about fuck you," Barry said.
"Fair enough." Again, Sanders nodded. Winters pulled a towel over Barry's face. He was struggling, shaking his head back and forth, at least as much as the pulled taut towel would allow. Biddeford started pouring water over his head from an orange Home Depot 5-gallon bucket. The sputtering and choking was followed immediately by whimpers to stop.
"Again," Sanders said to Biddeford.
It was a strange sensation to watch a man get tortured, not something I was completely on board with. But this man could hold the key to me getting the rest of my family back, so basically, fuck him. By the time Biddeford had emptied that second pail, the man was sobbing. He had absolutely been broken. I honestly didn't want to know how much torture I could endure, but fuck, I hope it would be more than 10 gallons of water that did me in.
"Stop! Stop!" he sputtered. "I'll tell you whatever you want to know. Please just stop."
Probably a good thing he was done, because Biddeford didn't have any more water. Talk about an economy of tribulation.
"Pretty unique sensation, isn't it?" Sanders seemed bemused.
All right. Let's start with where Knox is. Barry spewed forth more information than a breached server from a Fortune 500 company. He even started talking about how he missed his Miyaku, which some guy had taken from him. We felt bad, until we found out that it was not his girlfriend in the normal sense, but just his anime pillow. When he began to talk about the people of mine they had captured, I thought my heart was going to break through my chest. Felt like I was the one drowning. When we were all done and had gotten more information than we had ever wanted, we went upstairs to figure out a game plan.
What about me? Barry begged.
You're staying here, Barry, Sanders said. I mean, unless you want to fight on our side. Silence from the table. And then he spoke, just as the door was closing.
You can't leave me here. I'll die. Then it's dark. I don't want to die in the dark.
Bedford, put a gag on him, please, Sanders said. I looked to BT. I didn't disagree with what the Major was doing, but holy fuck if it wasn't hardcore. We went to the dining room. Sanders pulled out a map of the area and spread it out. Knox was about a mile away in a small office building. I know that place, Winters said. Mostly brick. Got a couple of windows on street level. Fairly secure, especially against a small assault. It's two stories and has clear lines of sight in these three directions. He traced his finger on the map. It stands to reason if Knox has any sort of military mind, he will have patrols out, especially for this blind spot, Sanders said. We don't really have the numbers or the equipment to do this. Sanders was looking at me. Listen, Major, you've already done more than I could have ever hoped for. My own life is in your debt, but my family is in there. I can't walk away from this, but I understand if you do. No part of that was me walking away from it. I'm just saying it's long odds for success. Long odds, BT laughed. Shit, man, we haven't had any odds for so long that even long ones are welcome. I fist-bumped the man. Winters and Bitterford got a kick out of that. Sanders, not so much. With Tommy and Travis, we were seven strong, heading into the teeth of Knox's army. I would have brought Justin and Tracy, but someone needed to stay and watch that group, and I didn't think two more guns were going to change anything. We got close enough to the building to get some visuals. Looked like a party on the roof. Had to have been a dozen people patrolling up there. The street was much more modest. Six men with guns that we could see. Had to guess more than a dozen we couldn't. Creeping up was out of the question. Brute force, which was my preferred method, also seemed unrealistic. Sanders was just beginning to direct us to the only approach that had some merit when Knox showed himself. Talbot, he shouted, just come out. We have some things we need to discuss. I looked up and flipped the techno bird in the sky, aptly enough, the bird. Come, come, there's no reason to be rude. Don't make me compel you to come out into the open. Before I could do anything, he nodded to someone off to the side. Then my daughter appeared, with a rather large revolver held to her head. What are you doing? Sanders asked when I got up. He knows we're here, and that's my daughter. What do you expect me to do? I stood my ground. It's nice to know you're reasonable, Knox was smiling, which was further unsettling. Just a couple more things, though. Really gonna need you to put the rifle down, and the rest of your little Girl Scout troop is gonna have to come out as well. I don't want any accidents to happen. I undid the strap holding my rifle and placed it on the ground. I'm here. Let's trade. Me for my daughter, I yelled. Not that simple, really. There are some things we need to discuss first. This is an all-or-nothing scenario, and trust me, I'm not trying to be dramatic when I tell you the clock is ticking. BT came out. What the fuck are you doing? I asked. We stand together, brothers forever. I appreciate the sentiment, but if you're dating my sister, that's going to get real awkward. You know? I turned to him. Well, I didn't know for sure. Not until now. Shit, BT muttered. You two done? Everyone, Talbot, or I'll kill them all and do what I can on my own. What the hell does that mean? I whispered. He's insane. How the fuck do I know? BT responded. You two idiots ever hear of a directional microphone? Knox asked. Listen, I'm gonna make this easy. even something a Marine can understand. Phillips, get the screen. Gonna do an audio-visual presentation for you. Pretty sure you'll figure it out quick enough. Heard a generator kick on, and then a large-screen television was brought onto the roof. Two of Knox's men were holding it up. In for a dime, I started walking closer. You're pretty cheap with your life. BT was matching my strides. I'll say, now I have to split it. Can't buy much with a nickel. The screen powered on. I was actually watching myself walk toward Knox. Hated the show, got bad reviews, and had horrible plot lines. Who willingly gives themselves up to a madman? Only have another 2 minutes of view time. You might want to get closer, Knox warned. Not sure if we'll be able to keep up this ceasefire agreement for another 45 minutes. The guards at the building entrance let us in. We walked by at least 50 soldiers, and they watched us pass with murderous intent in their eyes. Can't say I was a fan of that gauntlet. My heart soared when I saw my daughter. I'm here. Put that gun down or I'm going to shove it up your ass, I told the man. He sniffed, shrugged a little, and then lowered the gun, putting it back in its holster. Nicole came to me and hugged me tightly. We're all right. Just hear him out, Dad, she said. I didn't like that at all. I'd read about Stockholm Syndrome, but never understood it. Who in the hell starts to identify with the crazy people holding you hostage? I always thought that excuse was a pile of shit. I kept watching the screen as Knox fiddled with the controls on the device and panned out. Wasn't a few seconds later when I think my stomach dropped out through my anus. Too much? Because fuck if that wasn't what it felt like. So which is it? Knox asked. Like a kick to the teeth or to the balls? Both, I told him honestly. How many? BT asked. I was too transfixed by the sight to say anything. Software started to freeze up somewhere around 95,000. Figure that might be a little light, but what's a couple tens of thousands among friends? You didn't do this, I finally managed to ask. If I had this much power, the world would already be mine, he said. This is why I haven't put a bullet in your head. I'm not sure what, if anything, your group can do, but it looks like we're going to need each other's help to get out of this. I didn't even know where to begin. The small town we were in was surrounded by zombies, and not just a few scattered around, but one giant, thick, unbroken circle around the whole town, and we were in the middle, like a bullseye. How could this happen? Where could so many zombies come from, and why gather like this? I was more than hoping you might have an answer, he said. How many men do you have? I asked. He didn't hesitate. 120, and I've radioed for the rest to come here. Total's about 500. Never had I thought we were so outmanned by Knox. Figured he had 40 at the most. Sure, still pretty bad, but not pulling dried rat shit flakes from your cereal, fucked. Oh, and just in case you didn't know, there used to be an acceptable level of rat feces allowed by the government to be in your cereal. Bon appetit. Talbot, what is going on up there? Sanders asked. I'd been so taken back by the pictures on the screen, I almost forgot what we were here to do. Things have changed, I yelled down to him. You can probably only see a blob from down there, but this entire town is surrounded by zombies. 100,000, maybe more. Not doctored? Sanders asked. Do I look like I know how to use Photoshop? Knox said to me. Definitely not, I told Sanders. I'm coming up. No weapons, Knox said. Horse shit. Sanders holstered his weapon and was with us in a few minutes. I noticed him looking pretty intently at a certain area of the map without trying to make it too obvious. I had a good idea where Kylie and Tracy were, and it didn't look good, as the house was right in the heavy band of the undead. So what does this shitbird want us to do about it? Sanders asked me. I didn't think poking the psychopath was such a good idea. Knox laughed it off like they were friends, and this was an old routine. All right, I'm good, he said to his men. All of them left, like each and every fucking one of them. Yes, I realize there are three of you and just little old me up here. But remember, I still have members of your family, and if I were to, say, make a two-story leap from here, they would suffer some harm as well. I wanted to tell him I'd take my chances, but I wasn't interested. Not at all. Go on, I told him. Listen, your group has been kicking my ass since we came across you. I chased you down because I wanted to make an example of those that would stand against my rise to power. Sanders scoffed. Knox continued. I had hoped for a quick kill and an absorption of some of your people. Double win for me. When that didn't happen, it was becoming difficult trying to justify this detour with my followers. I was trying to find a way to pull the plug on the entire operation, take who I had with me, and go back. But the zombies changed that, I said. So now, what? We're just going to be one big, cohesive, happy unit and work together for the greater good? Oh, I still want you and him dead, he pointed to BT, in the worst way possible, like so much I can feel it in my toes. It was not lost on me that he jabbed a finger into his head when he said toes. But you're leaving the East Coast completely. That much I got from your man. I can live with that. I can spin it that I forced you out. You go live on your coast and I'll live on mine. Someday I will have the power over all of this land and we will meet again, but that's in the future. We have to deal with the present, with today. If we don't make it out of here, how can we continue our legendary conflict? This guy was certifiable, but I could play the nuts game. I'd walked that fence long enough to speak the same language. Like Ali Fraser, Tyson Holyfield, North and South Korea. Shit, even like North and South Carolina, I said. He gets it, BT stopped me. I do get it, Knox said excitedly, that old familiar slant of insanity burning heavily through his eyes. I don't want to die here. This isn't my destiny. I'm meant for much greater things. I've been told that. I left it alone that it was only the voices in his head that had told him anything of the sort. We were playing nice, and he still had possession of my toys, so to speak, and I wanted them back all in one piece. I get my people back, and then we talk in earnest, I told him. Hey, it's not like I can go anywhere. I don't like that. What's to stop you from going it alone, Knox asked. Listen, man, I'm fucking nuts, I get it. But it seems to me that you're bringing much more to the party than I am. Not really thrilled to say it, but we need you more than you need us, I told him. Just hand him the keys to the city, BT said. It was easy enough to tell from Sanders' stance he was thinking the same thing. I like the insurance of having them around. You're very pliable this way, Knox said. Talbot, right now, I've been assured that Knox's head is in the sights of my unit's best sniper. You say the word, I have him taken out, and we launch a rescue attempt for your family. Sanders lifted his uniform to reveal three pistols in his waistband. See, this is what I'm talking about. None of you ever give up. Why you don't want to join me is beyond my understanding. Knox lifted a small radio to his mouth. Phillips, release our guests. BT and I looked over the lip of the building as my sister, her son, Gary, Ryan, Nicole, and Wesley exited the building. Sanders had kept his eye on Knox the entire time. What about Deneau? I asked, once I saw that Biddeford had met and then moved my loved ones away. Knox smiled at that. No, no, you can't have that one. She's very important to me now. He pointed to the device. She made it perfectly clear that killing her will end this thing's usefulness. And now that I have it, I can't imagine how I ever survived without it. You should have been more careful. Plus, she made it abundantly clear that if I exposed her, you would more than likely put a bullet in her head. Trust me, I'd be doing you a favor. Since we're friends and all now, I'll let you in on a little secret. That woman isn't a fox in a henhouse. She's a wolf. Her! She's a frail old woman. Yeah, you keep telling yourself that while she smokes a cigarette over your body, BT said. There was another car, I said. We found the wreck. Some blood. But no one was in it, Knox said. I wasn't so sure I believed him. It was more likely he was lying and was going to use them against me if I tried anything, or even if I didn't.
How long until your reinforcements get here? Sanders asked.
They're on their way. Should only be a couple of hours.
What kind of weaponry do they have? He asked.
So we're buddy-buddy, BT asked me, while Sanders